to come join us. I would like to open the meeting by making a couple of just housekeeping remarks, if I could. When I went back to my materials this weekend, I really had not focused on it, but realized that our report is due on January 15th of next year, 2015. So it's not much time. And what my hope was, as long as my co-chair and everyone agrees that that makes sense, would be to wait until after the holidays and meet that first week of January to actually see if we could vote and support some kind of set of recommendations. And the statute requires us to submit to the committees of jurisdiction, which I believe are basically Children's Committee, General Law, and maybe Health, our recommendations and findings, whatever we have. So we're coming to the end of our effort, and actually the legislation says once we make these findings, we dissolve and we are no longer members of this august committee. Secondly, I just wanted to take a moment and go through the composition of the committee, because I was looking at that as well, and would just ask that you correct me if I'm wrong, but based on the latest chart I have, the Speaker of the House appointed David Newman, the President Pro Tem appointed Ann Hulick, the House Majority Leader appointed Dean Thomas Metzl as a non-voting member, but he has not attended meetings, so my guess is, you know, that he will not join us in voting or participation, but he's a non-voting member. Senate Majority Leader appointed Kathy Queen. The House Minority Leader did not make an appointment. That was a non-voting appointment, so that position obviously is irrelevant. The Senate Minority Leader appointed Tim Phelan. The House Chair for Children, the House Chair for General Law, Diane and myself. The State Chair, the Senate Chair for Children appointed Representative Vargas. The Senate Chair appointed Lou Esposito. And the House Ranking from Children, Anthony DeGeorge. The House Ranking from General Law, Dan Carter. The Senate Ranking from Children, Brent Cleveland. The Senate Ranking, General Law, Kevin Witkos. And then we have the DCP represented by Richard Maloney and Department of Health by Dr. Gary Ginsburg. And I believe that the two agency heads are non-voting, but I'm not 100% sure on that. We have to double check that. But that essentially is the group that I have. And I don't know if there are any corrections either by staff or other members of that. So obviously today is an opportunity for the roundtable discussion. And when we do set the meeting, I'm hoping that everybody who's a member of the task force will appear and read past minutes and debates and discussions. But my understanding, and we'll have legal counsel give us a definitive opinion, that when we do have the meeting to vote, I believe it's a majority of those present and voting, as opposed to a majority of the entire committee that's capable of voting. Would that be correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Since the first meeting, you voted to follow the joint rules, where applicable, that would be the majority. And then also, when you had mentioned the two agency commissioners, Commissioner of Consumer Protection and their designee, and Public Health and their designee, those would be, their designees would be voting members. It doesn't say ex officio.
Okay. Well, that's helpful. And we can review that again at the next meeting, just so everybody understands the rules. We'll have enough controversy and discussion. We don't need to get into more controversy over rules, so hopefully we'll all be on the same page as far as that goes. Let me ask, before I begin the discussion, the substantive discussion, if my co-chair would like to make any remarks.
No, I am all set, and I turn it back over to you.
In accordance with the custom that we've adopted for the task force, where the co-chairs have made remarks, I would like to start the discussion off by sharing with you some of my thoughts. And these are ideas that I have put together after going through my notes, going through the minutes of the various meetings and the people that we identified as expert witnesses, doing some due diligence of my own, looking to our resource people for assistance. And this is what I've come up with that probably won't make either side of this issue entirely happy, but I think represents a good compromise, and it's a compromise that I would hope is fair, that most importantly protects the children of our state and also holds our manufacturers to a standard that will keep our children safe, but also is fair in terms of the technology we have and the ability to make sure that our tests are not excessively burdensome beyond what is necessary to protect the children of our state. So with that, let me describe for you what my concept is. I'm proposing a two-test standard. The first test would be in the discretion of the Department of Consumer Protection, DCP as I call it, which would be authorized to use the 75 parts per million standard for the surface coating test. And the test results must be at or below the 75 parts per million to pass. If DCP, in their discretion, decided not to use this test in any situation, it would still give notice to manufacturers that the surface test is available for DCP use, and that if they fail to comply, then they would fail this test. And the reason why I made it discretionary is because the next test I'm suggesting be mandatory, but I wanted the manufacturers to not take for granted that the first test that I just discussed would never be instituted, so that it keeps them on their toes to make sure that they're in full compliance with our expectations. But the second test, which would be required by DCP, would be the 300 parts per million standard for total content, and a jewelry item would have to undergo that test even if it passed the 75 parts per million test, which is the coating surface test. If DCP decided not to do this surface test, they still would have to do the total content or 300 parts per million test. These test methods can include the XRF, which I understand is more the X-ray wand type of thing, or the total digestion test, as designated by the ASTM, the National Association. If the test results were above the 300 parts per million, it would fail, even if it passed the 75 parts per million test. So it's really, again, the main test is the 300 parts per million. It has to pass that test. But if DCP decided to do spot checks and do the 75 parts per million, even if it passes that first test, they still have to do the second test, and it would have to pass both. If the jewelry item, however, has no paint or surface coating on it, then you would just do the 300 parts per million test, because there would be no reason to do the surface test, as I understand it. The total content test would be applied separately to each component part of the jewelry, which I think is consistent with prior protocol. Third, that the total content test would be conducted again in accordance with ASTM protocols, except that if you failed the 300 parts per million test, that would be the end of the testing standard. There would be no more tests for leaching or extraction, which is sometimes referred to as solubility. And the reason why I'm proposing that we not do the third part, is that this solubility test, in reviewing my notes, makes a lot of assumptions that were controversial. And there are some experts that we interviewed who take issue with the predictability and the variability of the tests. And there's also a concern about who would perform those tests, the reliability of the labs, and the cost, quite frankly, to the state. So I know that in some instances, the solubility tests helped manufacturers a little bit, because if they failed the content test, there was a way of showing that through the solubility, even though you had a higher recorded result, it still might pass based upon the assumptions that were made. But I feel that if we keep this simple and just go to these total content and surface tests, that it gives us the ability to determine if jewelry is unsafe to our children, and that we can enforce this and apply it without a lot of complications and controversy. These tests, in many ways, parallel what is often referred to as the California test. We went through a number of states, you know, what each one does. The overwhelming majority of states do nothing. So obviously we're well ahead of the curve if we adopt this standard. But this test, I believe, would be a little more stringent than the California test, because we're adding the ability to do the surface test as well, and we're not leaving it simply at the total content test with the 300 parts per million, which I believe is what California does. The next three proposals would be, number one, to give enforcement powers to DCP to pull items off the shelf and to allow for testing and verification, to make sure they had the full authority to do that. The fifth would be to provide fines for any violations of exceeding the legal limits for the test that I proposed. And lastly, to provide an informational section on the DCP website. It could be on the health or children's website as well, to make parents aware of safety issues involving children's jewelry and precautions that they can take to avoid the kinds of accidents that we heard about. And that informational section could also apply to many other items that children swallow accidentally that we have heard vivid testimony about regarding jewelry and toys and all sorts of things, because those are things that are near and dear to us too. We want to make sure our children are protected from all these things. So this is my proposal to the committee. Certainly it's not an attempt to undermine or stifle debate in any way. It's I hope a good solid foundation for discussion going forward, with the hope that maybe we could focus our discussion, but certainly anybody has a right to articulate and convey their thoughts or their own suggested ideas. And again, today's session is not intended to vote, but really just to share our ideas, ask any questions of our resource people that are still lingering in our minds, with the hope that we will become a little more educated, fine-tuned on the final issues, and be prepared at the next meeting to vote. So that's basically what I have to say, and I would just thank everybody on the task force because it's been a great experience, and I fully respect everybody's point of view on this task force, whether you're on one side or the other. The one thing I think we can all agree upon is that we definitely want to protect the children in our state. We may have different paths or ideas on how to get there, but there's no doubt in my mind that ultimately we're serving on this task force because we want to make sure that what we implement through statute is sufficient to protect our children. So with that, let me turn it over to my co-chair if she would like to make any comments.
Thanks, David, and I think that what you come up here with here bears a lot of discussion, and I think you've done a really good job of trying to put together a compromise standard, like a hybrid, can I call it? A hybrid standard. And in reviewing California's, I would like to be able to just use Dr. Ginsburg for a second to give us a little better perspective on the total product content as opposed to the solubility in the 300 parts per million, and how the 75 parts per million for the surface coating test would impact any of the resources that we would need to be doing this. Is this within our resource? Are we creating a standard that's going to be incredibly difficult to impose? And at the end of that, Gary, if you talked about the total content and the solubility, that'd be great.
Okay, well, I think I'll start with the total content, number 300, which is 4 times higher than the 2010 passed legislation total content. So it shifts the amount we would be allowing in cadmium in children's jewelry up fourfold, which is higher than what Canada's draft requirements are. It's considerably higher than what the state of Washington has, but it does match what California has. And what I've done, I haven't gone through details of calculations in this committee, but I have done some calculations of worst case, looking at Dr. Wiedenhammer's marred surface data, which showed the greatest leachability. And if you take his worst case numbers and put something like 300 parts, start the content at 300 parts per million and see how much you can get through a child's digestive system, from off the item and then absorbed, you would still be matching the CPSC target acute number of basically 0.11 micrograms per kilogram per day. So it works. I mean, 300 is a protective number. 75, I've never been able to trace exactly where. I wasn't part of the thought process in 2010 where the 75 came from, but I think it ties back in to the first part of what Representative Baram was talking about, and that's the surface coating. And it would just be an easy test for somebody to come along with an XRF and say, if it fails at 75, regardless of whether it's a surface paint or whether it's the whole item, but anything above 75, you're done. And that's the way it was written in 2010. It's the simplest, most mindless testing. But I do see the value of having more, somewhat more involved testing, but still relatively simple, of being able to test the surface coating separately with an XRF to see if it passes, because that is going to be more biologically available to the child. Let's face it, if you could scratch it off, you could tooth it off, fingernail it off, if that's got 75 parts per million in it, that's going to be much more immediately extractable and available to the child. I don't know that you need a solubility test on that. I mean, 75 parts per million, simple test with an XRF. If it passes that, then you scratch away that initial and look below it with the XRF to see if it's got above 300. And if there's anything borderline questionable, you could always go to atomic absorption and the more detailed testing, but that could be up to DCP. So I think it's feasible. I think the 300 protective, and I think that the 75 as a surface test with an XRF would also be relatively simple to do.
I think one of the conundrums for me is I took a look at the California legislation, and California initially said banning cadmium. That was their initial bill. Then their second bill was 75 parts per million total product content, and then they ended up with a 300 parts per million total product content. So it's really difficult as a legislator and not an expert in the field to say which one is the correct one and which one is the one that's going to give our children the protection that we want them to have. I believe, and if somebody can verify or not this, I think Europe's at 100 parts per million. And so I would probably throw that one out as a instead of a 300 parts per million, a 100 parts per million standard, simply because in any initial look at the cadmium in children's jewelry, when we first found it, almost every report that you saw said, just don't let children have it at all. Just don't. So if we're talking about children's jewelry, and when we started seeing these parts per million, that were hugely high, and I believe that New York has just come out with their toxicology report, which again took a look at children's jewelry and found that even after all this whole brouhaha, that the cadmium contents were up yet again in children's jewelry. So because this is specific to children, and because of the initial reports from our own consumer protection and the national consumer protection, and that just stay away from it for little kids, I would probably be thinking to see if we could go with a lower number, notwithstanding, I understand, where did 75 parts per million come from? Where did 100 parts per million come from? Where did 300 parts per million come from? I guess my feeling would be they came from the lowest number that they could think of and still have the jewelry not fail, would be my suspicion.
If I could just respond, if this was a long-term chronic exposure, which would lead to a chronic buildup in the kidney and other organs, I would say that the lower, the better. But we're talking about what's theoretically a one-time acute exposure, which would be still, it would take a while for that to clear out of the child's body. But when you look at cadmium in the diet, day in and day out exposure, that we are, I think, within reason at 300, given that the percentage that would still extract out of the 300 would still be a minor. The greatest extraction rate by Weidenheimer was a very small percentage that would still come out of the total piece of jewelry. So in terms of the micrograms being taken up by the child relative to lifetime or longer-term dietary exposure, I think we're in a pretty good range at 300. What I think the big difference in my mind is whether you're at 300 or 3,000. When you start jumping up into the thousands, then I think we're talking about poisoning. And when we're talking about down where we are now, in the 75 to 300 range, we're talking about is there potential ability for that amount going to the kidney, targeted to the kidney, to lead to some kind of a chronic additional risk compared to what's in the diet already. And I personally am comfortable with the 300 from the numbers that I've looked at.
Thank you. I don't want to, unduly restrict anybody from speaking, and I like the give and take. So, as long as we're courteous and respectful of one another, if somebody makes a comment and you would like to ask a question of that person, I'll recognize you, but I'd like people, without necessarily formally going around, for your main thoughts to be able to jump in to the fray, so to speak, and answer questions. Representative Carter.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. You know, one of the questions that's come up in my mind, looking at where we're taking this path, is there are two things. We're looking at what we're going to establish in Connecticut law, or what we're going to recommend we establish regarding the 300 parts per million and the 75 parts per million surface test, and saying that's a requirement. And we're also saying that DCP can test for that. The part about the solubility testing is where I'm trying to get my head around, because in the beginning I started looking at solubility testing as a way to help manufacturers who, when a shipment shows up, if something is like amiss or it's more, it comes up more than 300 on the X-ray, that allowing them to go to the solubility test could keep a shipment from, you know, being tossed out on maybe a calibration error. It was kind of like a backup thing for the manufacturer. But the more I thought about it, the more I learned about it, solubility testing seemed to me as more of a safety mechanism. Because, you know, the larger the piece of jewelry, the more actual cadmium is in that piece of jewelry. You know, so the bigger the piece, the more grams, the more you're going to have in total weight of cadmium in that piece. And by doing some sort of solubility test, it seemed like a backup way to really ensure that something wasn't leaching or was really good. It was almost more safe for children. Now, with that said, I guess my question is, we can establish in Connecticut law and say, well, we're going to have the 300 parts per million and the 75 for the surface. But by not putting anything in about solubility at all, are we now conflicting with what, you know, they're doing at the border, so to speak, like letting these things into the country? Why can't we just say, well, we're going to have the same, as I would say, the industry standard, or where, I'm not even sure that's the industry standard, 375, maybe it is. But also say that what we'll test for in Connecticut is the surface test, and we'll test using the 300 parts per million. We won't do a solubility test because obviously DCP is very difficult. But we'll leave that in the regulation. That, you know what I'm saying? Because if something happens at the border, they bring this material into the country, and then all of a sudden, it's not at the parts per million total, but they do the solubility test and it's okay. For whatever reason, that could have been a calibration error with the instrument. Now we can't actually have that shipment come to Connecticut because it's against our law because it failed that first test. You follow me? I look at that solubility test as more of a restricted, not more of a safety test than I do a weaker test. If that makes sense. And I'd like to throw that up for anybody's consideration. Thank you.
Just in answer to my proposal, the reason why I dismissed the concept of the solubility test is that I was concerned that there was not a consensus among the experts about the veracity of that test. And when I just heard Dr. Ginsberg say, what would concern him is if we went from 300 parts per million to 3,000, that would be poisoning a child. And I'm just worried that these solubility tests, when I reviewed my notes, suggested that you could have a very high reading, but that the offsetting factor deals with how quickly it goes through the body, and there's so many assumptions. And I felt that we would never reach consensus on those points, and most importantly, that the citizens that we're representing wouldn't understand it, and they would question, how can you allow something that scores, let's say, 3,000? How can you call that safe? And for them to understand the complexities of solubility. So when I went through this in my own mind, I opted for simplicity. And you can correct me if I'm wrong, and, you know, Brent may have more information on this, but I believe that the national, so-called national standard, or ASTM testing, embraces items 1 and 2 of what I proposed, at least to some extent. They have a third component on the solubility. So even though I'm not recommending that, In a sense, two-thirds of what they've embraced, I'm suggesting that we adopt. And, you know, based upon what I'm hearing our resource people say and from prior meetings and questions, I too, as Dr. Ginsberg, feel comfortable that the 300 would protect our children, and that the Jewelry Association and the manufacturers would just have to live by that, and I think that they would, and I don't think that this would be that onerous for them to comply with, because I think they, in good faith, have said at prior meetings they're already trying to meet that standard. So we're not in the dark ages. Hopefully we're there, and this is just codifying that standard to make sure that the bad guys who come in don't take advantage of a state not having any testing standards at all.
I completely understand where you're going with that, and I'm not trying to. This is not a debate. Where my head's at is the solubility testing better to have that backup because of safety? Is it more safe for us to have some sort of solubility test? Because I don't know. Because listen, a lot of what we talked about in this committee was all based on, you know, first pass metabolism, what's going to happen in the body, you know, all these things. I guess my question is, you know, looking at the metals, can you have something actually be at 3,000 parts per million and pass the solubility test? I would think not, unless there's some sort of creative way to make the metal, or I don't know, but. It seems to me that I just want to make sure we talk that through. I'm not taking a stand, but I don't know that we should bail out on the solubility test yet until we've fully vetted that it might be more safe for our children to have that test in there somewhere. That's all. And that's my position. I'm looking at safety. I'm not looking at the other way around.
Yeah, I saw Dr. Ginsberg.
I think what could help you think about that is that the solubility test is really done in two different versions according to the ASTM approach. So if it's a big chunk, you're worried about the size having more cadmium associated with it. If it's a big chunk, they don't even assume that a child could swallow the whole thing, and it's a less vigorous test. It's a licking, it's a saliva test. So big does not mean more extraction. Big probably means less extraction, because they don't stick it in an acid bath for 24 hours. Brent could, I'm sure, clarify. But then let me just say the other concern you had about the testing and something, you know, not being right and catching an error by the second test. Second test is very different than the total content test that we're talking about, so it wouldn't give you the same kind of answer. And I would encourage manufacturers to go up their point of production and use XRF to screen. And, you know, if you're clearly in the thousands, you're in the wrong ballpark. And, you know, you don't want to make a lot of that for overseas production. If you're at around 500, you know, maybe on XRF, maybe it's a little off, maybe the machine isn't calibrated right, yeah, and then do the more, you know, complete digestive. They could figure that. I think that they've been in the business, know how to make jewelry, meet standards. They could probably figure that part out. But, yes, it is very possible to have 3,000 parts per million pass a test. And Dr. Weidenheimer's data showed that, because if it wasn't scratched or marred, but it had plenty in there, it wasn't leaching a lot. But as soon as he scratched the surface, he got or leached it longer, he got higher numbers. So what a child is going to do with it, the big problem with one of the big problems with the solubility test is it doesn't simulate what a child is going to do to it before they swallow it.
Brian?
Thank you. Boy, it's so difficult for me to be quiet over here. First off, you're talking about the mouthing test, and yes, that is subject to a solubility test of the mouthing saline solution, which has an 18 microgram limit. But basically, Mr. Chairman, I think it's your thought and your methodology is moving in the right direction. I think it's going to need a few tweaks. It's really important to remember that the total content specifies the presence of an element. Migration is the only way to test for health, for safety purposes. So let's talk about the 75 ppm. First off, that 75 ppm is a fraction. It's a ratio. There's 75 over 1 million. So that 1 million is, of course, 1 millionth of a gram. So that's 75 1 millionth of a gram. If a piece, and the current law in Connecticut is limiting it to 75. So if you had a 2-gram piece, you're allowing 150 right off the bat. Well, this is a children's bracelet, just for an example. This weighs 45 grams. So based on current Connecticut law, proposed law that has just been delayed, this would be okay in Connecticut at 3,187 micrograms. 3,000. So this indicates, the 3,000 you were saying would be really violative. The bottom line is, though, that this is only dangerous if it migrates. And so that's why the migration test becomes so important. That then indicates, first off, the migration test is not one that increases with the heavier a piece gets. It's a finite number. If it's 200 micrograms or more, it fails. It would have to be under 200 micrograms, no matter what size the piece, in order to pass. So that's why the solubility measures health. You know, it limits it to 200 parts per mil, 200 micrograms. Sorry.
Let's see.
There was reference to Canada. The Canada study was for children 3 and under, if you look, and they were limiting cadmium to 130 parts per million. In fact, what we're working on with Canada is to leave that 130 parts per million in place for jewelry 3 and under, because we don't actually recommend unsupervised use of jewelry by children 3 and under. They are considering using the standard for the other, which would be 4 to 15, because a child in Canada goes up to 15. But again, you know, the real mission that we have is that, first off, greater minds than mine went and created this risk assessment. In fact, the Consumer Product Safety Commission did a 58-page study determining where the risk laid. And so they came up with recommendations, which they they strongly suggested that the toy industry and the jewelry industry incorporate these cadmium testing protocols in their standards. We both did that. In fact, our testing protocol for cadmium matches that of the toy industry. The difference is that the toy industry is the ASTM F963 is attached to the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act, which is law. So all the toys that are in Connecticut are subject to the same cadmium testing protocol that's in the jewelry standard currently. Now, of course, that was to the satisfaction of Congress. It was recognized as being health protective. So I think, you know, a lot of people think that it's a matter of 75 ppm being a good number, 300 ppm being a bad number. It's really important to look at how that number is being used and how it's derived. Again, if it's a parts per million number, it's a fraction, and it will vary with the size of the piece. Are there any questions on any of that?
Dr. Ginsburg.
So would that bracelet that you held up be subjected to the acid digestion test, or would that be subjected to the licking test?
Well, that's a good question, because, of course, if you XRF this and it comes out at 70 parts per million, then it's going to pass.
Now, based upon the size of it.
The XRF doesn't measure size. The XRF is only going to measure the percent.
But according to the ASTM approach, which test would that be subjected to?
No, it would pass. Because even though there's total cadmium present, you know, it would come out at the micrograms, at the ppm would be under the acceptable level. You know, 75 is an acceptable
and
level.
And my point in response to Representative Carter was that something that size, it doesn't really matter so much how much the total cadmium is in it, because the child's not going to swallow that. It's not going to stay, it's not going to go down the windpipe. You're going to have to take that out surgically from the esophagus.
Well,
it's
actually,
you're not dealing with the total metal content, cadmium content that that I think Representative Carter was worried about.
Yeah.
We're talking about relatively small pieces that acid extraction test on the order of 20 grams, not 400 grams.
Well, and this, if it were broken, this would fit through the small part cylinder and is considered something that a child could swallow. So, but again, you see, the point I'm really trying to make is that when you XRF something, you're getting a percentage of the content of that piece. It'll tell you how much lead is in it, how much cadmium, how much zinc, how much what the metal composition is by percentage. It doesn't give you the total amount. So I was just bringing that point that, you know, the only way to measure the health risk is by determining what would migrate from it, which would be through a solubility or migration test.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, you know, one of the things that keeps coming up is if we have a piece of cadmium, let's say that, for instance. Let's say that comes out and a manufacturer makes that and somehow it's 3,000 parts per million, because inside each one of those little balls is a core that has more cadmium and there's just really heavy surface coat on the outside. I mean, I think that must be the dilemma that everybody's worried about, and that if it's ingested, then maybe the outside of it's so good it'll pass the test, but if it's marred up, then it would have passed the test but would have been dangerous. I mean, I think that's what we're trying to avoid, is the way I understand it.
Right.
So I guess, you know, when we were talking about how they make these different toys, they were talking about when you put cadmium in something, it's blended into the metal all throughout. How often do they use, I mean, this is going to be a trick question, how often have you seen that they've taken cadmium in a higher amount or needed a higher amount and covered it with something on the exterior that would pass the test? I mean, does that happen?
Right. Well, of course, there was discussion, especially with the Widenhammer study, about how if you plate a casted piece of metal and then you abrade the plating, that the concept is that the cadmium would come pouring out of the crack. Well, that doesn't happen because, of course, the cadmium is completely dispersed through the casting alloy. All you would be doing is you'd be increasing the surface area. Now, if the cadmium were, if the surface coating were to be sealing the cadmium in, this body of what's the right word? If it were to seal it in, then if you abrade it, you know, would it increase more? Actually not, because, again, you're just increasing the surface area of the piece. Specifically to your surface coating example, cadmium is used as an element to thin out solders to reduce the viscosity, or it's also used in certain dyes. I should say used to be used, because no one in their right mind would be adding cadmium to anything these days. The only cadmium that we're dealing with in the marketplace is considered trace amounts that would come through recycling gold. It could come through recycling the casting pots that were making jewelry, that kind of thing. But if you had a certain red and hot purple dyes, it was typical the cadmium could have been used in that dye, so therefore it would have more cadmium on the outside than the inside. There was examples years ago, back in the Widenhammer study days, you know, that was going back to 2008, he did buy some very high concentrated cadmium pieces, cadmium pieces that would fail our standard in a minute. You know, the average amount of his piece was 391,000 parts per million. You know, that's over a third cadmium. So, of course, that would have been enormously violative and would not pass today.
Let me call on Dr. Ginsberg to sort of help answer or clarify some of the comments. And then I'd like to resume going around the table. I want to make sure everyone has a chance to say something. Dr. Ginsberg?
I think Dr. Weidenheimer's point was that even though he had very high cadmium content, market shelf pieces of jewelry, they still passed the test if they were not damaged and if he extracted them for 24 hours, which is the CPSC/ASTM test. So in some cases, you would be doing the opposite of what you were trying to do and letting unsafe items on the shelf if, in one case, even without marring the surface, but if you did six replicates, three of them passed and three of them failed, just doing the test six times. But, of course, we don't expect the overseas company in China necessarily is going to do the test six times in whatever lab they're using to test the solubility, leachability. If they're making here's a theoretical, 5,000 parts per million, but you do the test once or twice, it passes, you put it on the market, you've got data from a lab overseas that we have no relationship with, that they did the test in duplicate and it passed. Weidenheimer shows in graph 1C that if you do the test enough times, some of those items, some of those tests of the same component pulled off the shelf might fail just because of variability in the coatings, variability in the manufacture, that when you're playing with fire, basically 5,000 or 10,000 or 30,000 parts per million of something as toxic as cadmium, you don't necessarily want to leave it up to an overseas lab doing some solubility test that then suddenly says, it's not going to be bioavailable. We can trust this. I mean, you know, from a state health department perspective, being able to rest assured knowing that that much cadmium in a toy is just not allowed at all. We don't have to worry about who did the test, how well they did the test, can a child mar the surface, how many replicates do we need to do to rest assured that it is truly not a hazard. Just knowing below 300, we've done, you know, the worst-case calculation on how much could extract out. We know that below that, we're probably, even if all of it extract, well, all of it wouldn't, but even a Weidenheimer's worst case, you still wouldn't get a problem. That is much more reassuring than trusting some other lab to document that it's not bioavailable.
And, of course, it's the federal government's position to trust but verify. And so even though every shipment of children's merchandise that comes into our country has a third-party testing lab certificate attached to it, CPSC also monitors at the border. It's interesting to note that there hasn't been a cadmium recall in 3 years, although they have sent goods back from the border. Again, we, as an industry and I think as a trade association, support standards. We just need them to be based on current science. And, of course, the minds and doctors and the experts at CPSC spent a huge amount of effort and a ton of taxpayer dollars developing the standard.
Okay, what I'd like to do is maybe start at this end here. And if you're not required to say anything, but if you would like to make a comment, share your own thoughts, ask a question, feel free to do it. Just ask you to push your button so that it picks up in the recording.
No, I'll pass. I'm still listening. Thank you.
I think my comment is that I really appreciate the analysis that you provided, Mr. Chairman, and it was a helpful starting place. And I appreciate the questions that have been raised and agree that all of us are really thinking about what is the best in the best interest and most health protective for children. You know, I come from a framework of being a nurse, and so I'm always thinking about the evidence, the science, and while I'm certainly not a toxicologist or a chemist, I always lean towards what could be the most health protective, and knowing how toxic cadmium is, and certainly understanding the industry's desire to harmonize, which I really understand. I understand that these different state laws are just not effective for anybody. I wonder if it might make sense to think about the, I forget who proposed it, but maybe the 75 ppm surface coating and then 100 ppm as the second test, only so that the industry is harmonizing with the European Union. That just seems to me to make some sense, and I just would want us to consider as a task force really striving to be the most health protective, not just establishing a health protective standard. And it's just, I think, from the basis of where I come from. Thank you very much for everyone's work on this.
Thank you. We'll keep going.
Thank you, Ann. Those were good comments. Thank you. And I want to thank the committee for all their hard work and well-thought-out analysis. I still struggle with enforcing the standard. There will be some challenges in doing so, whether it is the solubility or the XRF standard. So that would be the point of view that I would come from. But as the committee wrestles with this and chooses a standard, we at DCP will enforce that standard.
Representative Vargas, any comments you'd like to make?
Well, I didn't really know much about cadmium until I was appointed to this task force, and I've been reading a lot of material on it, listening to what people have to say about it. But I was familiar, having been a teacher 35 years in the Hartford Public Schools, with lead, mercury, and other heavy metals, and the effect they've had on children's brains, developing brains. So even though I didn't know much about cadmium, if you told me it's a heavy metal, I would probably have said it should have no place near children. And, you know, it reminds me when I was back in college, I tried my hand at oil painting, and one of my favorite colors was cadmium yellow. And I remember licking the brush, the tip of the brush, and now I wonder if that was a wise decision or not. But
you might have been president today if you hadn't had that.
Right. Who knows what could have been. The fact is that I probably would feel more comfortable with a zero tolerance policy on heavy metals and any children's products. But I am a pragmatist, and I know that probably we've polluted the air, the water. We probably have caused a lot of damage to Mother Earth already, and that probably you can't escape some level of contaminants in almost anything you do. So I appreciate what Representative Barrymore, co-chair, has done in trying to bring some compromise about. I also heard our other co-chair, Representative Urban, talk about maybe lowering it from 300 to 100. My own feeling would probably be along what Representative Urban is saying, taking the compromise position of Representative Barrymore, seeing if we could tighten it a little, maybe 150, somewhere in the middle between the 100 and the 300 standard. I realize that it's almost impossible to get rid of these pollutants, but I wish there were a way to just have a zero standard. That's just a gut feeling. I've seen what kids with lead poisoning, what it does to their ability to learn, and it has terrible consequences. So, and from what I've read, it seems that cadmium is actually more noxious than lead. So, you know, why it was used as a substitute, I know there's probably economic reasons for it, but when it comes to children's health, I'd rather err on the side of caution. Those are my initial thoughts. May I respond?
Thank you very much. Lou, anything that we're going to investigate on?
Not knowing that much about the testing methods, the only questions I would have, Representative Barron, would be on some of the other aspects of your proposal, like specifically on the fines imposed upon the retailer, I guess, is where it would be. Would it be imposed upon the retailer, the wholesaler, the distributor, the manufacturer, wherever that fall? And would the fine be appealable? And if the product is pulled from the shelves, would they still be fined for it? And that's on a separate issue. But on the testing standard, I know we've been going back and forth as to, you know, the federal standards that are being proposed as voluntary as opposed to how we're going to test it. I think we have to weigh it all, and I thought that your proposal was the most palatable of all. That I thought it struck a balance between what was being proposed and what is now acceptable from the California standards to other states. And I know we have to come to a consensus at some point so we can present it to the body further on, but I'm still not all that knowledgeable on where the testing should be and what the final number should be, but I certainly respect everyone's opinion that's come forth through this committee. I hope that we can reach a solution before our deadline, but I don't know what happens if we don't reach a solution, that it just falls off the table and goes back to square one. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. And with regard to the fines, I did not get that far. and I'm not sure, you know, I'm in a position to really suggest what the fine should be. With my co-chair's permission, we could ask our legal staff, who deals with fines all the time on consumer protection matters, to perhaps at our next meeting present to us a range of fines that might be appropriate based upon similar types of things, like counterfeit drugs and stuff like that, where we do impose fines and give DCP the authority for testing. They might be able to come up with some options for us to consider, along with any other ideas. Rich Hanabati?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Also, just for the committee's task force's rather information, this would be legislation. These are just recommendations that would be in your report, and any fines, if they're significant over a certain threshold, have to go through the Judiciary Committee, and that would be fleshed out through the legislative process. But we can certainly give you examples of existing legislation, cutoff provisions, monetary fines, etc. But this task force would submit its report and recommendations to the General Assembly, and the legislation would have to take its normal course through the committee process. But any sort of significant fines would have to be vetted in the Judiciary Committee, probably other committees as well.
Yep.
Sure.
Yes, and you may want to consider putting it into the State Child Protection Act. Currently, it sits as a standalone provision in the Connecticut General Statutes, but you could impose it into the State Child Protection Act, and all those applicable provisions within could apply.
Sorry, you said the State Child Protection Act?
That's correct.
Could you just share with us the basics of that?
Well, you have the Federal Hazardous Substance Act within there that would ban those hazardous substances, and you would also have associated penalties within the State Child Protection Act, such as lead and the like. And we follow and adopt the CPSC standards that we can go in and actually ban or tag and remove from the chain of commerce those items.
And based on your experience to consumer protection, would this also be likely to be a per se violation of the CUFTA, which is the Connecticut Unfair Trade Practices Act?
That's right, Co-Chairman. Within the State Child Protection Act is a provision, a cutoff provision, that says any violation of the Act is a violation of the Connecticut Unfair Trade Practices Act. Yes, sir.
I believe California, perhaps other states, with their cadmium standard, does have violation fines. So you might want to look at what the other states do. But I saw something in there per day fine of being on the market at an exceedance.
If I may, I'd like to just turn attention for a moment to a question that was asked, and I'm going to pick on Dr. Ginsburg to see what his thoughts were. When we were talking about the big necklace with the balls on there that Brent was holding up, and we were talking about percentage versus total content, I'm wondering if you could help clarify for us how that works. In other words, if you had this giant ball, it might have more cadmium content, but when we talk about any kind of a test, regardless of what the threshold is, are we talking about the content as measured per parts per million, or is it the overall content? So the bigger the piece, the more content it would fail by definition because of the size. If you could maybe clarify that issue.
The way the total content standard works, which is what we have now at 75 and what could be 100 or 300, you know, depending upon where that number ends up, would be a total content standard on a parts per million basis. So, yes, the larger the piece is, the more of the cadmium that would be allowed to be in the child's environment. That part is true. But in terms of what the child will actually swallow, you're limiting the acute exposure in terms of the size of the item to a certain chokeable or swallowable size. So you're limiting the total amount of cadmium you would be allowing in the product just based upon that size cutoff. And it is in the ASTM method. If it's below a certain number of inches or millimeters, then it gets the licking test, which is a less stringent test, because even though they allow less amount at the end of the line in terms of total amount allowed to be extracted, it's just a much less vigorous test because it's only saliva, not strong acid. So I think that answers part of your question, is that we're not allowing balls of, you know, high amounts of cadmium into a child's environment that could be absorbable cadmium because it wouldn't be swallowed. So in terms of the acute risk, the idea is that if we are concerned about how much could be absorbed and poisoning a child, a content standard on a reasonably sized piece of jewelry should work. And that may be a reason to err on the side of 100 instead of 300, because you could get a relatively larger size that a child might swallow. So that would allow more cadmium in the gut. Recognizing, though, that even if you had a golf ball and that was chock full of cadmium, you're still only absorbing the outer layers. You're never going to get all of it in the through the extraction process and into the stomach. It's still the what's going to be absorbable is going to be in the outer layers of it that gets digested by the stomach acids. So just size is not an easy and simple way to think about it. Content is, because the concentration that is right at that interface with the acid contents of the stomach, that's going to govern the rate at which cadmium comes off. So the higher that concentration is, if it's 300 versus 1,000, that would make a big difference in terms of the rate at which it's coming off. Theoretically, it's going to pass through the stomach or be taken out by a physician. But the concentration right at that interface with the gastric fluid is going to be a rate-determining step. What's in the middle isn't going to be available to that child anyway unless they chewed it to bits.
And before I recognize Brent, just one other question. You said earlier, and I just want to ask you again, that you didn't see from a toxicology standard any significant difference between 100 and 300. I think you said you would be worried if you were talking 300 to 3,000. So I just want to make sure that, you know, from a scientific perspective, are we talking about any substantial difference in terms of harm to a child between 100 parts per million threshold and the 300?
Right. So there's a lot of variability in all these systems. How long it's going to stay in the stomach, what the child ate around the time that he swallowed it. We don't know all the permutations, but under the fairly rigorous testing that Weidenheimer did with marring of the surface, he had the maximum extraction was at about 0.1%. And that's what I used in my calculations. And so if you start with 300 parts per million and you go with his worst case extraction, you're still within that acute milligrams, micrograms a day target to protect against acute poisoning effect. So that's what I based it upon. Sure, 100, I mean, you know, this is in the realm of risk management. And, you know, if the industry can meet within their testing variability and you know, and supply chain, if they can reliably meet 50 or 40, you know, as people have been saying, the less the better of cadmium. But within what we know about its acute effects and what I've seen in terms of extraction potentials from the Weidenheimer tests, I'm pretty comfortable that 300 would be protective. I don't think that much higher than that would be. I mean, you know, it's hard to draw that magic line in the sand, but I think that 300 would be protective.
Thank you. Brent?
Great, and I have a couple of questions or comments regarding Representative Vargas as well as Dr. Ginsberg. I'll start with Dr. Ginsberg. The statute that we're talking about now is going to be testing component parts. And so have you given any thought to exemptions to the testing? In other words, if there was a Mickey Mouse charm that had a dot of white paint that was the background of the eyeball and another dot of black paint that might have a weight of a thousandth of a gram or something, would you exclude that from testing requirements, or would that be something that you would put in? Dr. Ginsberg.
I suppose that that's something that has not come up in our discussions. I haven't seen it come up in the California legislation. If it can be shown up on the XRF as a scratchable, removable, dislodgeable, then it would be a 75 part per million limit. Yeah, you wouldn't want to have anything above that. So I would say probably would qualify as a failure. But maybe there would be, if there's a proposal on, you know, some de minimis level of speck of paint, maybe there's a way to think about that.
Well, it would make sense to eliminate some things, specks of dust, to save us all time. But the metal-containing jewelry law, which is the California law, does exempt crystal, for an example. And we heard testimony earlier from a doctor that's saying that whatever is in that crystal ball isn't bioavailable and therefore is not a problem. It would make sense to do that. However, Prop 65 went through and signed a consent agreement limiting cadmium to 300 parts per million separate from the law, which now has become the de facto standard in California, and that's where the 300 has come from. But let's see, you were also mentioning that, the Weidenheimer study, you know, the as I've mentioned before, the shame about that study is that he didn't break things apart by component part. And he went through and he tested the whole part in and of itself, and of course with different substances, you would have different rates of migration. And so it was too bad that happened. And, of course, they were all high cadmium pieces. I wish he had conformed to protocol so that we could have apples-to-apples kind of comparison. Earlier, Dr. Ginsberg, you were saying that you wouldn't have a problem with the 300 ppm acute exposure. Well, and actually what we're doing is we're limiting that exposure in the standard to 200 ppm. 200 micrograms is the limit that we have in the standard for migration. And so, of course, that's even more health protective than the 300. Let's see, two other comments to Representative Vargas. You were talking about the presence of cadmium and that it is mostly a contaminant. You're absolutely correct. The leading contributor to cadmium to humans is through smoke. And that's not just cigarettes. That's also burning buildings, burning leaves, and however smoke exists. And it's important to realize, too, that no one in the industry now is intentionally adding cadmium to anything. That might be something that would be interesting to put into your bill, to make it illegal to add cadmium, that it would only be available in trace amounts. And, of course, trace amounts could be anywhere from 20, 30, 40 parts per million. There was a playground in New York that tested 45 parts per million in the dirt. Leafy vegetables is also a contributor of cadmium because of the cadmium in the dirt. It gets into the water, gets into the leafy vegetables, and we consume it. It's also in our water in parts per billion, just like arsenic is in water in parts per billion. So I think the key is, you know, that we have all made incredible efforts and have a desire to eliminate these chemicals from our supply chain and from, you know, our environment. You just can't go to zero. It just isn't. And I think that what we've done is made enormous strides and enormous progress in removing this, and we are proud of that. Let's see. And again, Mr. Chairman, you know, you are so close, I feel, in my opinion, to having a really great standard here. I think the key is that the CPSC found that migration testing on the surface components was very important because the surface component would be the most bioavailable, would be the most easily attackable, and would have the highest risk to health. Again, through total content, you're measuring the total amount of an element present. It has nothing to do with a risk assessment. And so by migration testing is the way to determine what would be bioavailable and therefore establishing risk. A change might be to have soluble on the surface coatings and then to have the migration option yielding less than the 300 go down to 200, which would be what the CPSC recommends. We're very close to reaching consensus, and I also thank the committee for the work. We've listened to a lot of testimony, and I hope everyone has enjoyed the experience and learned a lot. Any questions?
I actually have a couple.
Great.
If you could, first of all, you talked about crystal. Are we talking about a crystal jewelry piece?
Yes.
And could you explain briefly why that's exempted in California law? Is it because the crystal doesn't break down? Or?
Well, as we heard the doctor say, I asked him if his grandson called him and said he had just swallowed a marble, what would he recommend he do? And he said, well, do nothing, because whatever's in that marble is not going to be bioavailable. The reality is that the hydrochloric acid in the human system cannot digest glass. In fact, when they have to digest glass, they use hydrofluoric acid, which is 100 times more acidic than hydrochloric. So whatever is in that glass is not bioavailable, and that's why you all have glasses that have been passed down by your grandmother that's lead-filled crystal. Well, that lead-filled crystal is 350,000 ppm. It's 35% lead. And why is that considered not a health risk? It's because it's embedded in the glass. It's not bioavailable. In fact, I was asked, too. They said, well, geez, what if the glass breaks and you swallow a piece? Well, that still is not going to be bioavailable because you cannot digest glass. So to specifically refer to your question, glass and crystal is also rhinestones. And, that is very prevalent in jewelry. And glass beads would also be in jewelry. Considering that most glass beads are in cavities in jewelry that would be glued in, and we have a very active kitchen jewelry manufacturing industry in our country, sometimes those pieces will become loose and be swallowed. And if they were, again, whatever would be in that glass would not be bioavailable. So that's why California exempted it.
My second question, you mentioned the 200 parts per million, and I think you were tying that to a migration or solubility test. But what would be your reaction to a 200 parts per million for an overall content test?
I don't think that it adds anything to the safety of children's products on the counter. I think that the difference, I have heard testimony from a variety of sources that 100, 300 parts per million really has no bearing at all on the health protection. One reason we have the 300 ppm screening level in the standard is because 100% of the time we have had a non-detect when you do a migration testing on 300 or below. 100% of the time it's not present. So that's why we actually, on the ASTM committee, were looking at original numbers of 1.5%, which is 15,000 ppm. Well, we knew that would never make it, and so we were looking at California law, and we all made a compromise, and we settled on the 300 ppm as a screening limit. So that's where that came from. Now, one thing, too, at 75 ppm total content in current Connecticut law, realize if that came out 80, that would be violative, where there is zero health risk differential between 75 and 80, let alone 100 to 300.
Are there any more, let's say, first-time comments, anybody who hasn't spoken who feels they would like to say something at this time?
I'm sitting here listening, and as I said before, I'm still a little more confused than I was previously. However, I think Representative Vargas's comment, I, too, have been looking at young children with lead poisoning and stuff over the years, over the last 40-something years. And I don't want to see that happen to anybody ever again. And I get my confusion here is that we seem to be throwing numbers around as if there was something here that you know, that if we pick 200 as opposed to 300 or 100 as opposed to 300, that it's going to make a difference. And I think, Brent, your comment about, you know, well, we're getting this in smoke and, you know, cadmium is around. That may, in fact, I mean, I understand that in fact, is true. But I really think that it's important for us to note that for that reason alone, we probably ought to go for a lesser number as opposed to saying, well, it doesn't really matter then. So I think it's important that we look at this from a standard that will not be difficult for the industry or for the consumer, but rather safe for the kids. That's just number one. There doesn't seem to be agreement worldwide about the numbers game, but I think there ought to be at some point some interest in making sure that we come to some sort of agreement about those things. And if the European Union has come up with a figure of 100, saying, okay, the total content shall be no more than that, and you're saying, really, it doesn't make much difference between 100 and 300, then why not go with something that's going to give us numbers that are uniform? I'm more concerned, I think, about the way in which you don't want to make testing so difficult that nothing will ever get to the store shelves. But on the other hand, I don't want us to get to create a smokescreen, if you will, of testing variability in such a way that we can get something poisonous back on our shelves because we tested it some other way. And so I think it's important for us to come up with recommendations that are as simple and understandable as possible and don't leave room for that variability that we know that any industry can come up with in a hurry. I could talk your socks off about why kids do what they do, and I could probably justify almost anything they did, and you wouldn't be any the wiser. And I know you can do the same to me about jewelry. And so I really want to be very careful, I think, that we come up with something simple enough that we can, and something enforceable, that we can say is fair to everyone, most importantly, is safe for our kids. So I guess I'm in agreement with the folks that have suggested that we look at just some uniform number, perhaps like that of the European Union. At least that puts us in good company.
May I respond?
Sure.
Well, the European Union also has a limit of 500 ppm in lead, and our children's standard is 100. So it really does go both ways, and we are dealing with harmonization issues, both with Health Canada and the European Union and China. Argentina has accepted the standard. We're aggressively seeking harmonization. And no one, first of all, I'm not sitting here in defense of using cadmium in anything. Cadmium should be out of everything. It should be out to whatever level it could possibly attain itself. However, you know, if you're looking to make a standard, you can't just make a standard and say, well, gee, let's have none. You have to determine where the health risk is, and that's, of course, what the CPSE and our exponent testing did reveal. So that is the protocol that we're following. We're not in defense of using cadmium. We're vehemently opposed to it, but we're actively seeking to have standards that are based in science. Also, the best way to have uniformity and consensus in a standard is to have harmony, and having a single harmonized standard will reduce public confusion. It'll support compliance. It'll make it. It'll give manufacturers a single set of rules to follow, and would we believe improve compliance?
Could I mean, when we're saying we're opposed to using cadmium in anything because it's a heavy metal. Wasn't it Dr. Bruckner who was talking about a substitute for cadmium, and yet the substitute for cadmium, the price was such that it would have been. It would have made the jewelry not cheap kids' jewelry. and I believe it was zinc that was the substitute. Mm-hmm. So if we are using cadmium, are you suggesting that we should have zero tolerance for cadmium? That would be a great standard. I'd mm-hmm. be happy with that one.
Well, we as an industry support no added cadmium, which means that the only cadmium that would be present in any casting alloys you're using would be trace amounts. You know, one key thing regarding that zinc that has moved enormously. I'm sorry.
So what is the industry able to tolerate in terms of natural crustal background of cadmium in metal? I mean, are we talking about a 50, 100, 200? What?
Well, that's a good question. We went through and did some testing on precious metal bracelets, for an example, and we have one sterling silver bracelet that tested at 1,524 ppm. That was because a lot of precious metal jewelry is recycled. And that as people go and they have, you know, are cashing in the cash for gold places and all that metal does make it back into the supply chain. Not all jewelry is made from virgin, you know, 3-9 fine bars. So that's where a lot of the contaminants come from. And again, you know, the 1,500 ppm is still a small number. I mean, I brought a thing. I was going to write all this out for you. We're talking about 75 over 1 million. That, you know, that's six zeros. These are tiny numbers. So again, I think that answered the question. Zinc is the metal that you're referring to that used to be expensive, way more expensive than it is now, because you needed to have a steel mold to cast zinc in. Now you can cast it in rubber. They have high-temperature rubbers so that it is much more easily to make the molds and therefore production. So it's come a long way. And even to the point when all of this happened and crystal became a problem and it was questionable whether crystal was going to get an exemption in California, for an example, Swarovski went and re-engineered their production. Now 100% of their product falls beneath 100 ppm. This is enormously significant. I mean, this is the largest producer of crystal product in the world. They do 4 billion euros. They're also an optical company that make lenses and all kinds of things, but they're a crystal specialist, and they have now eliminated lead from their production.
I'm still a little confused. I was under the impression that cadmium was used because of the melting temperature was lower and it was shiny. But you're saying they don't use it at all if they can't. If they can avoid using it, they use zinc?
Yes. And what is happening now is that, well, cadmium lowers the viscosity of the metal. So therefore, if you have a filigree casting, you know, a casting that has lots of holes in it, all that metal has to go through that rubber and make it to the end of that cavity. Cadmium in that example would reduce the viscosity of the casting metal and shoot out into the molds and you'd get a better fill. Now there isn't a lot of cadmium, there isn't a lot of filigree jewelry out there. You can design around these kinds of things. You have better flow into the cavity and that kind of design change.
Dr. Ginsburg and then Representative Carter.
Yeah, I don't think we should lose sight of the fact that the lead standards are total content standards in children's products and in jewelry, so that we understand that in terms of how to keep a toxic metal out of that product and out of the system of a child can be better managed and regulated based upon total content than rather than some secondary testing. And I think that's, in my mind, the main question in front of us. Are we going to allow a second tier of testing to then allow something with a higher amount of cadmium in it or lead in it, which the lead testing does not allow that. The lead testing is the simplest version of this standard would be total content, just the way we do it for lead. And allowing extra testing in the door to then justify a larger amount in the jewelry when you could start then getting involved in what else is the child going to do with it, how long might it sit in the stomach relative to the test, then you start running into big question marks about whether the 5,000 or the 2,000 that would be allowed by the simple CPSC test or the ASTM test, the extraction testing, would that really simulate what's going on in the real world? And one other thing I want to say about that we talk a lot about how great the ASTM 2010 testing was, And if you go through that document, you'll see that the way they tested cadmium leaching in the solubility test was on simple wires and on simple powders. And they got good reproducible results. So they didn't test their methodology out on jewelry. What they tested the methodology on jewelry for was for lead leaching. And there the results were all over the place. So even their own data is not particularly confidence inspiring. And then you have Dr. Weidenheimer's results, which are even less confidence inspiring in terms of that method.
You have your light on. I don't know if you're asking to be. No. Okay. Dan, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I will have to run after this, unfortunately, but thank you, everybody, for being here. This is a good opportunity to discuss this. And I appreciate the fact that on the task force, there's been a lot of participation, which is good, really good. One of the questions that's still concerning me, and I don't know where I'm going to come down on this, but I'm going to do some research, is the 300 parts per million number. You know, we keep throwing 100, 300 kind of around. You know, I've been messing around and looking online, and the thing that I did find out is the World Health Organization says 7 micrograms per kilogram per day is what's safe, because most of the cadmium around us is in our diet. And that's when you're looking at men and women and kids, that they have that threshold, and they say that's what they consider somewhat safe in the diet, because we're going to get it no matter what. I would love to know at the end of this, in our next meeting, if we can pick one of these standards that at least takes that into consideration, because, you know, the 300 parts per million and the 100 parts per million and the 50 and the 75, and we're throwing it, they're very arbitrary to me. You know, if we find out that these standards are somewhat, you know, in line with safety, like if somebody's going to ingest something and it's going to be in its fullest form, not leached, not anything, I'd like to know that we're at least looking at that. And if we're a little bit lower, that makes sense, but to the lowest extent possible that we can comply with, I shouldn't say comply with, but maybe align ourselves with standards around the world or here, the 300 parts per million, I think we should be looking at that as a possibility. So that's my last comment, and I look forward to being back for the next meeting. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any other comments or questions?
If I could just respond to that last comment, I think that that is the right way to think about it, is that, you know, the World Health Organization, I'm not sure you got the number right, 7, it might be 0.7, but whatever that daily dose is on an acute basis, because this kid's going to get it in a shot all at once, so it's not a long-term average, but whatever that non-toxic or relatively safe level is on a daily basis for an acute basis, we have to make sure that you can't get that from the jewelry. And I think whether it's 100 parts per million, 300 parts per million, I can do some calculations around that and present those to the committee. Other people can, you know, make calculations as well. But I could show you some of the things that I've thought about. But that's where I'm going, is exactly where you're going.
Are there any other comments or questions? Oh, I'm sorry, did I miss something? I'm sorry. So, Dr. Ginsburg, you're going to bring back some calculations to us. If you complete those before the next meeting, if you could forward those to the co-chairs so we can look at them and then send them out. So I'm trying to give people as much time to prepare, because the last meeting really shouldn't be a meeting to start looking at new information. It really is to synthesize what we've heard. Are there any other comments?
If I heard correctly, the 200 parts per million was acceptable to the industry. Did I hear that correctly?
That was on a migration test, which is solubility, which is something we've discussed. Some people like and some people don't like, and was not part of my proposal because of the controversy around it. This was one of our best meetings in the sense that we had a chance to share thoughts, and while I'm not sure we have consensus on everything, I think we have more consensus than we did on day one. So that's good. That's positive. What my goal and my co-chair goal would be is to schedule a meeting for the first week of January so that we don't have to worry about the holidays, give people a chance to think this through. And the co-chairs, I think, will meet and work hard to see if we can put all this information together to try and help and facilitate in reaching a consensus at the next meeting. And again, I just want to thank everybody. This has been a great effort, and clearly when I think about the first meeting and where we were all over the place trying to understand, not that we totally understand it, but we're closer, I think we're all heading in the same direction more than we've been before. So I thank you for that. And Representative Urban, anything? No. Okay, well, okay, last word.
Very quick. An added benefit of adopting this standard will be the protection for batteries, magnets, sharp points, liquid, all kinds of things in addition to cadmium that are causing surgery. And I mentioned to you were saying there would be a website that you would put together as part of this. There's already a website, which is called saferproducts.gov, and it's part of the Consumer Product Safety Commission's complete compilation of health risks and hazards. So that's where you can get all the data of that. But thank you, and I've enjoyed being part of this.
Thanks. Well, that's a good ending comment for people to go to safeproducts.gov. And with that, I want to wish everybody a healthy and happy new year, and we will see everybody back invigorated, enthusiastic, and don't drink too much for New Year's Eve. Thank you.